Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade. Welcome. Today, I'm delighted to have Lena Elson with me. She is founding partner at Spread Health. We've known each other for quite some time, Lena. I'm so glad that you came on the podcast. Before I go any further, by the way, I really have to congratulate you because Spread is an amazing success story. I've watched you guys grow and you're just going exponentially. And obviously, I know that we all know each other in the business, but you have brought on some really smart people and you're growing like crazy. So congratulations. I'm really, really pleased for that.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. That's so nice of you. And yeah, I'm very proud of my team, I must say. And I'm super pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. Now, I mean, I know Spread as a kind of like post NDA kind of entity, but really, you do much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we started Legacy Sprout was related to behavior change, adherence to treatment, patient support programs, that kind of thing. And really, you know, when you work in that space, the question is always, how can we engage earlier? You know, and to me, because I've also, you know, have a background in COA research and patient preferences, really the answer is to bring in COA because we can engage earlier with clients, you know, and even move that back then to even preclinical, you know, patient engagement and really work with the pharma company through the full drug development pathway. And, you know, our vision was that that's great. And we can really build this amazing knowledge base and understanding of the patient and their needs. By the time we come to launch, we can create something really valuable in terms of supporting patients also in the real world. Now, that's not necessarily what happens because teams are often siloed within pharma, and some of that is actually dictated by regulations in terms of connections between clinical development and the commercial teams and so on. But there might be some changes coming.
In what way now? Hold on. In what way? Because, you know, there's a lot in that. If we unpack that slightly, patient centricity, the key word, and I know the regulators are very focused on that. We're all very focused on that. And we all want to be in the conversation very early to try and get ahead of the very tight FPI dates we have. Comes as kind of like a squeeze point, like a bottleneck, where you, me, Johnny, ECOA provider, everyone wants to be in the conversation early on. And that creates in itself a challenge. How do you handle that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think also there's sort of the requirement or the ask of being there early, I think is often fair, you know, and really it might not be about, you know, having a massive table and everyone are there at the same time, but really being smarter of how we collect and use data in terms of understanding the patient experience and how we can create, you know, a drug development pathway, which is truly patient-centric, you know, all the way through launch.
Yeah, I think Big Pharma, they have an advantage in that they have a department that can quarterback this, very American phrase, but they can marshal all these resources trying to get into conversation. Is that a fair thing? And then the second thing to that is, how does mid-sized pharma and biotech handle that? Because often they don't have the resource that big pharma have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there really is some big pharma pioneers, you know, that have had patient engagement and advocacy teams that span the full drug development pathway and all the different stakeholders within that pathway internally at pharma, you know, for many, many years, probably more than 20 years. And, you know, we work with some of those roles now, and I think that's wonderful. I think in some ways, you know, for thinking of the small pharma, like the biotech, sometimes they're even closer to the patient. You know, they really have often a really close relationship with patient advocacy organizations, for example, and they truly understand and are very passionate about the patients that they serve. And they might, you know, have one asset with a few indication or a couple of assets. And I think that's wonderful. With mid-sized pharma, you know, who don't have the resources to have these roles that span the full drug development pathway, like really being smart of where they invest. You know, for example, we are working with some mid-sized pharma which are investing in their COA strategy, a comprehensive COA strategy upfront, pre-phase one. They're really early in terms of trying to understand the patient needs and what the gaps are, both in the sort of what patients need for the drug development and also in terms of meaningful outcomes. So I think it's about, you know, working with each client and the kind of resources and restrictions that they work within and find a solution that really fits for them in terms of patient engagement in a way that is valuable, you know, not just for the company, but also for the patient community.
I think that's fair. I think there's another challenge, I think, in that. I mean, that would be the holy grail, wouldn't it? That would be the perfect scenario that you have people who would allow you in. But I think one of the challenges, and I've had sponsors on this podcast who've, you know, said, basically, you know, we have an FPI date and that's set in stone and everyone else is backward engineering to get to that FPI date. And preclinical might be the place to start, because then we really are in the conversation and we can shape that those dates and we can shape that timeline. That's a useful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, there is always these restrictions around timelines and resources, budgets, you know, and I think really that makes it interesting as well. And sometimes there are areas where you really cannot compromise, you know, and there are other areas where you can, you know, evaluate the risks with taking a certain approach. And, you know, you might be able to manage those risks and come to a successful program, and also in terms of what is acceptable to regulators and reimbursement agencies.
Yeah. And the other thing to mention, we glanced over it, is like regulators now are accepting COAs as part of their data. It's not just an add-on anymore. It's very much part of the decision-making process. Where does Sprouts fit into that? Where do you, like, whereabouts are you guys in the process?
Yeah, I mean, we work with the pharma companies in terms of anything that has with the patient voice to do through the full drug development pathway, including COA. I think it's really exciting that it has become a must-have. You know, like when I started, it was a nice-to-have still. And what I think it's really interesting now, that not only do regulators and also really a lot of the reimbursement agencies asking for patient experience data and really truly showing how you have done that in a meaningful way, not just as a tick box exercise. And I think it's really interesting that they are now accepting, and not just accepting, but asking for qualitative evidence. So, you know, we have seen a huge increase in some pharma companies planning for it, and also with regulators when they see a COA strategy and what we are planning to do in a trial, they actually ask for the addition of embedded interviews. And that might be, you know, enrollment interviews, or it could be throughout the trial, or it could be at exit, which is probably the most common, or even at follow-up to be able to help with the interpretation of the COA data. I think that's a really interesting development.
Totally agree with you. I mean, you know, the in-study interviews, relatively new, it doesn't seem to be done routinely, and it should be. And it's wonderful data we're getting for in-study interviews. The post-study interviews, we've been doing that for quite some time. So in-study interviews, there's an incredible amount of data that we get from that. And I know that on the podcast, we had someone on that talked about in-study interviews, that they want to talk about it. Do you do that as well routinely? Do you advise sponsors to do in-study interviews?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we have had, you know, the examples of where we have created a COA strategy, told the sponsors that really we think that you could strengthen your evidence here by including embedded in study interviews. And they have said, you know, we don't really have time, or we don't really have the resources to do that. And when we have got to regulators, to the FDA, to get feedback on the strategy, they have requested embedded in study interviews. So I think there is a real appetite, let's say, for regulators to actually see that data planned for and included, so that you can help interpret the COA data, meaningful change, and really understand the experience of patients within the trial. We have had also examples of sponsors that have been asked to do those kind of follow-up interviews, so that, you know, where there might have been some questions around durability and that kind of thing, and actually regulators are asking for interviews that follow up to be able to get comprehensive data on the long-term benefits of treatment.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think it's as common as we're talking about here. We're talking like it happens in every study. It doesn't, for some reason. No. And we know the regulators want it. So I guess, is it resource that we're not doing it? Is it time we're not doing it? Why do you think it hasn't been such an uptake in study interviews?
I think it's, yeah, resource, budget, timelines. But I think, you know, the changes within pharma, which is such a conservative business, really, you know, overall, change happens when regulators request it. And, you know, we had that with COA or PRO data, you know, it was a nice to have. Then, you know, the guidance in 2009 was published and, you know, regulators start to request it and also to have the evidence that this is, you know, valid and reliable and appropriate and meaningful, you know, and now it's not a nice to have anymore. And I think in trial interviews, we see a similar trend of regulators starting to ask for. And I think that this is now also what's happening with patient engagement, because that has always, you know, involving and truly letting patient experience and their voices guide the drug development. I would say that is still on the nice to have side, but it is changing. And it's because regulators and reimbursement agencies are asking for evidence that it has been done and it has been done properly. That it, you know, there is no proper change. There's always some pioneers and there's always some companies that do it amazingly ahead of time, whether it's required or not, you know, because they truly think about the patients. But I think once regulators ask for it, that's when change happens. Yeah.
And then there's the whole thing about oncology studies. And we had this before, where oncology studies where you're gathering data from patients. Do you gather that data before treatment? Do you gather that data after treatment? That whole thing of like eating food is quickly forgotten. These patients are already very ill. And we're getting data from them before the treatment. I mean, what's your experience of those sort of oncology trials?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and also I listened to one of your earlier podcasts by our friend Bill Byram. And I think, you know, he was pointing out how we very often we measure the impact of treatment at the next treatment administration. So patients have to sort of try and remember what it was like just after it happened, you know, right after administration. And I mean, I could share something with you, Mark, which I don't talk about very often in a professional setting, but I have a personal experience as a cancer patient. So just after we launched Sprout, I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, full works of treatment, you know, half a year of chemotherapy, surgery, radiotherapy. And something which I hadn't thought about is, or hadn't experienced and didn't know, was that, you know, digital screens in itself vastly exacerbate nausea. So, you know, you have a situation where you listen to these ideas about the importance of capturing data right after the administration, especially in terms of safety and the impact. And you might have a situation then if you use, say, bring your own device and, you know, digital screen, you know, a lot of patients are not even going to be able to look at the screen, you know, so you have a lot of missing data. At the same time, those people who might brave through and actually look at the screen, you might have slightly skewed data because the way you capture the data is influencing how patients are feeling. And I think that really, you know, brought home how important it is then, say, for example, for eCOA providers who very often come on board, you know, maybe 3 months before a pivotal trial and they're going to code it and maybe they have time to do some cognitive interviews, usability testing, maybe with patients, hopefully with patients, and then they launch. And these kind of issues then only become apparent once you've actually launched. Wouldn't it be wonderful then if eCOA providers could be there, you know, preclinical, and they could ask the questions already then in the really early engagement with patients, what would work for you? What kind of data capture would be suitable within the trial? You know, and they might be able to plan for a much better development program, really considering what kind of data capture is appropriate for patients, you know, audio voice response perhaps. And also, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if the eCOA providers could test the systems in phase one, you know, and by the time you come for a pivotal trial, you have everything that you need to really capture data in a way that works well for the patients and minimize the risk of, you know, biased or missing data. I know what you're going to ask, Mark. You're going to say, fine, you know, for big pharma, 15 you know, early assets in the pipeline for oncology, they might be able to invest in setting their systems up really early on and, you know, trialing it. But what about mid-sized pharma with 3 assets, or what about biotechs that have 1?
Biotechs, yeah.
You know, they don't have those kind of resources to do that. And perhaps that's fair, but then maybe we can rethink. And, you know, I sort of briefly touched on this earlier, like rethink truly how we are patient-centric and how we capture and create an environment where really the patient is at the center. And if I can bring in an example, and this is actually from clinical practice. So a hospital that treats complex patients, so these might be rare diseases, multimorbid, you know, patients come in and they have really quite a burdensome day, let's say, meeting with different specialists in different departments, you know, and each department are trying to think, how can we, our, you know, oncologist or physiotherapist or dietitian or whatever it is, how can we be truly patient-centric? And this hospital was saying, well, wait a minute, like, let's really rethink how we do this, you know, to be truly patient-centric. Why don't we put literally the patient in the center? And we have all of the experts coming to see the patient where they are physically in the hospital. And I just think that's such a great way of really turning it, you know, another way to really consider the patient, you know. And if we bring that back then to pharma, a really important piece of patient-centric deliverable or asset or what you want to call it is a patient journey within a company. You do that preclinical, you want to know unmet need, maybe explore outcomes, learning about what might work from the patient perspective in terms of the trial design. You know, once you get into HR and COA strategy, then, you know, you want to understand the patient journey, the signs and the symptoms and what might be meaningful for them in terms of outcome. Once you come towards launch, you know, there is another investment in another patient journey where really the focus is what are still the unmet needs of patients despite their journey? What is the care environment in all these different countries where we're going to launch. And so you have different stakeholders within a pharma company asking the same patient community the same questions, more or less. Mm-hmm. And you also have all these different companies who work in that space at all those time points asking the same patients the same questions, you know. How about if we really rethink what it's like to be patient-centric and hand over the ownership of an important asset like the patient journey to the patient organizations. And I know that there are patient-led organizations that are really advocating for that to happen. And then big pharma, mid-sized pharma, biotech agencies, you know, can all invest, bring resources to the patient community, help them to develop and keep up to date and build on these patient journeys that then might be sold for a pay for, you know, license fee for any pharma, any size to be able to use and learn from, vastly reducing the burden on the patient community and really having an asset that is truly validated and kept up to date. Like, I think that's really a wonderful way to, like, how can we be innovative in the way that we for the whole ecosystem support them.
I never heard that before, to be honest. That truly is patient centricity.
Yeah.
You take this back for 1 second because this is fascinating. You talked about patients in oncology and the screens post-treatment, the screens could often be a challenge. I never thought about that. We think about that in migraine studies. We think about that because the screens can trigger. But I've never thought about it in oncology studies. That's just proof that we need to get in early. We need to sanity check our mode of capture, sanity check the patient cohort that actually it's suitable for them. This is fascinating. I hadn't thought of it. I hadn't thought of that. Fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm telling you, you know, when you take chemo, it takes about 4 hours for the side effects to come on and then it hits you. And for about 3 days after that, electronic screens would be terrible. And I'm thinking back, you know, I might be biased in my recall, but I'm thinking if I had someone calling me a voice response, I could have done that as long as the voice wasn't too electronic, you know. And I think now with the development in the AI captures, like, you can really have a pleasant voice, you know.
Are we going back to IVRS? God, I don't know about that. Genuinely, this has been fantastic. One last question. I always end my podcast with one last question, okay? If you had a magic wand, right? You can have anything you want. What would you do? What would you change? What would you wish for? And I don't care if it's industry or if it's regulated, whatever. What would you wish for? Mm-hmm. What's the most pressing thing for Lena?
Oh, I love that question, Mark. Thank you. The possibilities. I spoke with a colleague about something like this a few days ago. And really, if we could have, you know, everyone within the ecosystem walking in each other's shoes to truly understand the experience and motivations of that stakeholder. Everyone knows what I mean. And not only, you know, let's have pharma employees walking in the shoes of the patient or the caregiver. Absolutely, that's very valuable. But also in each other's shoes, you know, because I think internally at pharma, there is so much push and pull and, you know, there's different priorities and different KPIs and, you know, and sometimes that can create tension. And I think if you can really, truly have internal stakeholders as well as external stakeholders really understand what motivates them. And, you know, everyone is trying to do a good job. We might have different collaborations within pharma. Yeah.
I love it. Try walking in my shoes. That's great.
When I see
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Personal note, I just want to say thank you. You shared some very personal thing. I feel gratified that you would come on and share that with me. So I feel very gratified by that. Thank you so much. Today, I was talking to Lena Allison. She's founding partner at Sprout Health. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much, Lena. Join us next time on Transperfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade. Thank you.